Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bezanko and Scott Parkin.
Hi everybody, this is Bob Bezanko, co-host of the Green and Red podcast with a special show this morning we've put together because there's a lot going on, as we all know, in the news. And one of the big news stories last week, which really didn't get as much attention as it might have otherwise because so many other things are going on, was a really dramatic, let's call it, court case, a court decision in North Dakota. And so today we're going to talk with somebody who knows as much about this as anybody in the U.S., and that's investigative journalist Will Potter. Will has been on two or three times already with us. He's a friend of the show. Well, very well regarded, well known. I'm not going to go through your whole biography. That would take too long. But degrees from UT Austin and Johns Hopkins, published extensively in many different places, won awards, a TED Fellow, professor at the University of Michigan. I believe it was in the School of Journalism.
And yeah, they shut down the School of Journalism, but it was in the English department.
Yeah. And you're at the University of Denver Law School now, right?
Yep. Liberal Rights Fellow.
And published extensively, best known, I think, for Green is the New Red, which is a really important book talking about how the government takes the kinds of strategies and tactics it used, like in the Cold War and against communism, and it adapts it to other groups, including terrorism. And as you know, that's the name of our podcast, right? The Green and Red podcast. So we were thinking along the same lines. And then a new book, which is coming out real soon, right?
Conundrum.
Red Barns. Yeah. And so we would, and well, we can mention that at the end too. But to get started, so we have this case in North Dakota stemming out of the protest that occurred, what, over eight years ago now. Do you want to just do like a brief backgrounder on that, how we got to this point? And just like for people, if you haven't watched it yet, we did an interview just like last week, I think, on slap suits with a lawyer who works on that. So that actually fits into this too. So you might want to check that out. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I highly recommend that for folks. That was a great conversation you guys had. I checked that out as well.
Yeah.
So to give people a little bit of a crash course in this, going back to 2016-17 with the Standing Rock protests, which now feels like ancient history in some ways, right? But this was the protest that was really led by Indigenous First Nations groups against the pipeline construction that would be desecrating some of their sacred burial grounds, also jeopardizing water. So this movement erupted that was led by Indigenous communities, but then you had environmentalists that were trying to lend a hand in that. And that's really the heart of this. Greenpeace was involved. They do trainings for nonviolent civil disobedience, and they've done this forever. And so they come in and they teach people how to do things like civil disobedience and deal with police. And their emphasis is always on nonviolence. And that's important to remember here. And anyway, as those protests were building and gaining steam, the pipeline company was obviously getting more and more upset. They brought in a heavily militarized police presence. If folks remember the images of water cannons and attack dogs being used on First Nations and environmental protesters and journalists in freezing conditions, that was the tenor of that moment, right? So there was a lot of violence that happened at Standing Rock, but it wasn't from the protesters. It's from the police and this militarized mercenary presence. But that's a long way of saying that the pipeline company fought back against this in a couple different ways over the last few years. They tried to use RICO, which is the Racketeer Influenced Corrupt Organizations Act, or also known as the mob law, the law that's most known for used going after the mafia. And that didn't work. As an aside, there's been a lot of attempts to use RICO against environmental groups and other protest groups in different ways. Greenpeace has had several of these suits over the years. The pipeline company, it didn't work with RICO, and so they kicked it back and filed in North Dakota. And that's really where the problems start with this case. The jury was overwhelmingly folks connected to the industry. This is in a county that, if I'm not mistaken, I wrote that down in my notes. Oh, it was 79% Trump. But they were very deliberate of picking where they filed this like backup lawsuit motion. And what folks need to know is that lawsuits like this are really called slap suits because they're strategic lawsuits against public participation. The companies know that they may not win, but they're trying to tie up protesters in the courts and suck up their resources and money And that's really what happened in this case. The ruling, it was just astounding. The jury came back with a $660 million ruling against Greenpeace, saying they were part of a conspiracy to shut down the pipeline. There's all kinds of rhetoric about them being outside agitators, which as Bob goes back to the 60s and really before that even.
Yeah.
This kind of mythology of these aren't actually the authentic protesters. This is some big conspiracy that came in. And Greenpeace from the start was like, no, we're not leading this. This is our rodeo, man. Like, we're letting the people on the ground lead it. They were really on the periphery and were pretty open about that, but they're the one who got really hit the hardest for it. So this lawsuit and the ruling, it's just really far reaching implications across social movements. Marty Garbus, who was one of the attorneys for Nelson Mandela, also for Vaclav Havel, really key international historic cases, said publicly, this is the most egregious First Amendment ruling that they've seen in contemporary US history. It really is going to have ramifications for all protest movements.
Yeah, because Energy Transfer's basic argument was that by its words, Greenpeace was damaging the interests of their company. There's no allegation of anything like destruction, violence, nothing of that sort.
Nothing. And that's really important to emphasize. Not once in this whole clown car of a courtroom proceeding was there any evidence that was rolled out to try to allege that Greenpeace was involved in property destruction, sabotage, trying to train people to fight the cops, whatever kind of hysteria you want to think about. They never tried to argue it, which is mind-blowing, right? Like, they use this language in the press, but when it came to the courtroom, they never tried to argue that. And it was all about them, Greenpeace, being part of this conspiracy to shut down the pipeline. And they also used rhetoric around defamation. But the heart of this was the conspiracy argument.
Yes.
And harassment as well.
Yeah. Where does it go now? I'm not aware. Can they appeal or outside of North Dakota? Because if you're in North Dakota, they've gone venue hunting and one last thing, because you do this for everybody. When you hear about these, I think one's first inclination is to almost laugh. That's absurd. That's ridiculous. And is that kind of how people approach this initially? You got to be kidding.
I tell you what, man, that's been one of the biggest challenges in my work across the kind of trajectory of it. Is it does elicit that response from people. Because I think reasonable people, not radicals or activists, but just like people that just have some common sense about them, hear things like this and they're like, how does that happen? It's almost like we're leaving out key bits of information that would otherwise explain why this is warranted. And I really want to emphasize to folks, that's not the case. We're reaching this point, and we have been for a number of years, if you guys have talked about on the show, that no matter how absurd all this stuff sounds, it's has traction and it's actually working. And I think that's one of the most dangerous aspects of this is thinking about, like you said, where do we go from here? This is a dangerous ruling in and of itself, but it's within the context of the rise of an outright authoritarian regime in the United States that's veering and has promised roundups of protesters, promised shooting protesters, promised lawsuits against journalists and newsroom raids, and is now using social media to identify foreign nationals who have even spoken about Trump or Gaza to be on the front of the list for deportation. So I think we have to both look at this Greenpeace case as a tactic that we're going to be seeing more of, RICO, lap suits, oil and gas industry fighting back on a dying planet. And then we also have to look at this in the context of the rise of fascism. And the CEO of the pipeline company is a huge Trump supporter. Like we said, it happened in a district that was overwhelmingly Trump. These things are all connected. And it's also connected in this kind of video I put up the other day that you mentioned. We need to remember this isn't just an environmental movement issue. Like, people need to get that out of their head real fast. This isn't about Greenpeace. It's not about hippies or environmentalists or even pipeline protests. This is the playbook. And that playbook, I think we're going to see accelerating across social movements as we already are right now.
Is GP in this particular case, which wasn't like, you know, directing the events there, was it targeted just because it's so big? It's our, maybe the biggest environmental and we're well known. So if you could get Greenpeace, you can get anybody. Is that kind of the idea?
I think they've been explicit about that. Yeah. I think that's a really important point to remember too, that if you look at in Greenness, the New Red, I talked about this, but now since the publication of that book, it's spread even further. This started the rhetoric of eco-terrorism, the rhetoric of like radical environmentalists started with people that were more radical, that were doing sabotage and property destruction. And also in their ideology were a bit more radical of like connecting this to capitalism explicitly and things like that. We're past a threshold that now is shifting towards the mainstream. And I think Greenpeace represents that. The reason that a group like that is targeted is both to defund the movement, right? Because this is one of the heavy kind of institutional voices. And it's also to disrupt the broader movement. Because if you can take down, like you said, a key player like Greenpeace, then shit, everybody is at risk, right? The local activist campaign, the more militant groups, everybody is at risk. And I think that's a valid concern right now. They're trying to bankrupt Greenpeace and also bankrupt an entire movement.
Greenpeace put out a statement yesterday or today, which is pretty assertive, pretty adamant. We're not going to take this lying down and we're going to appeal it. Going forward, what do they do? I'm not a lawyer. Is there a good chance of appeal? Can they get these cases out of North Dakota? How does this affect specifically Greenpeace? Because they're big and it's kind of a canary in a coal mine again, right? If you could get Greenpeace to that.
I think there's a couple of things. We need to remember that, yes, this is a really dangerous ruling. It is not done. Greenpeace is already clear that they're appealing. As you might imagine, I don't have an enormous amount of faith in that process. And I would even go so far as to say, I think we need to break ourselves out of this spell a little bit right now of thinking that courts are going to continue to be a check or a balance or even a safeguard of this descent into fascism. And we're seeing that tested across the board. Trump administration is deporting people in defiance of court orders. Like, they're just flagrantly doing that. It is hard to say. That doesn't mean there isn't resistance among judges or people that are pushing back. It doesn't mean it's not possible for Greenpeace to succeed in the appeal. But I think we also have to keep in mind, like, what happens if they don't? What happens if they can't? And I don't know. I've been thinking about this a lot the last couple of days. And really all I can say to that is that I think this is one of those moments where we have to remember that we need to be willing to go for broke. If this bankrupts Greenpeace, they still did what they needed to do. And they showed up in the right way at Standing Rock. They utilized their skills and resources the best they could. They did all the right things. And the fact that it arrived at this point, I don't think the takeaway of that is we need to do things differently next time. I think it's, well, sometimes we have to be willing to go for broke. If we throw a punch and it comes back at us tenfold, or in this case, 20-fold, the ruling is about 20 times Greenpeace's annual budget.
Yeah.
And I think those are the stakes right now. We're facing a climate catastrophe. And I think this is a gut check for a lot of folks right now of what we're willing to put on the line. And unfortunately, Greenpeace is right out front in this.
Well, especially because right now we're seeing so much capitulation, right? Media, other politicians, comedians are saying, I'm going to, so you have this pervasive fear, and it's important, I think, to, even if they pay the price for it, to see what Greenpeace did. I have another question, because I know that this is like a part of what you do. And when we started talking about terrorism, I think we always have, but especially after 9/11, and that became the buzzword for everybody. And it became very politicized. And so I remember very early on, liberals were very upset. Why is that terrorism? But this isn't. And so they started using the same language. I think it was Bush's advisor, Matthew Dowd, who said, once they start using our language, we won. And I kept hearing liberals say, this is terrorism and this is terror. Why isn't this terrorism? Do you think that, in a sense, contributed to this atmosphere where you could do these terrorist enhancements on environmentalists and animal rights activists and things like what we're seeing today?
Yeah, I think this is a trap that liberals have fallen into historically, is they think that expanded state power, authoritarian power, can still be turned around to their benefit, can still be used somehow. And we saw that with the terrorism rhetoric, both in a linguistic sense, a rhetorical sense. There's a lot of times over the years, I got in arguments with folks of, we can't just say, oh, the real terrorists are X. Like, I know it's tempting and it fits our values to want to be like, the pipeline company is the terrorist because of this and this, but it does what you said. This goes into Frank Lutz's work, right? Of just like, you create the language and then exactly like you said, Bob, once that is accepted into the popular discourse, the battle is won. And so I think what I've seen in my work is how thoroughly institutionalized that rhetoric has become. It has just become the default. It used to be that raised alarms and people would try to push back and say things about who the real terrorists are. Now, I don't even think it raises an eyebrow. And now, like in the Greenpeace case, we saw that it was less about rhetoric of terrorism, which is really interesting to me, and more about radicals. And that, I think, is a really important historic shift that we're seeing right now, that they are trying to use this case as a bridge between the mainstream, the NGOs, the international NGOs like Greenpeace, and this boogeyman of the radical, right? And the more they're able to do that, it's going to open the gateway to going after, frankly, everybody.
Yeah, which we're seeing right now. Which is actually a good point, right? What's happening in North Dakota involves this pipeline. But what we're seeing right now is way bigger than that. When we talked to you a couple months ago, we discussed this as well. The situation is getting more intense by the day. One thing that, and this reminds me of in particular, is Cop City, because they're facing similar charges. Were they RICO'd in Cop City?
They were RICO'd as well.
They were RICO'd in Cop City. Yeah. Okay. And this is, again, for a nonviolent protest. The police actually murdered one of the activists there. They're just violate left and right, just basic due process and things like that. Is there much of a pushback on these things? What are people doing?
That's a great question. There is pushback. There's always pushback. Yeah. I feel the sense I have right now is that people are just in a state of being stunned. And I think that's goes back to Bannon, the Trump administration's entire strategy explicitly.
It's explicit. Yeah.
Blood the
I keep wondering why they're so shocked, because they've been telegraphing this for years.
And that's what I'm struggling to process right now, too. But that being said, like, we and many others have been saying this is the direction we're going for years. And I don't know about you, I feel this right now, this like stunned of surprise.
Yeah.
But it's still like completely disorienting. It feels like you really got a right hook to the jaw. What is happening? And I think that's they're just trying to keep up that pace, because we frankly need to realize we don't have a popular movement and structure in place for the level of resistance that's required right now. And I say that not to be negative, just an honest assessment of Anthony Romero of the ACLU, I thought had a good statement the other day, talking about the Trump administration's refusal to even acknowledge the legitimacy of the judiciary anymore. And somebody asked him, like, where do we go from here? And he's like, we have to shut the entire country down. And that's what we have to do. And the question is, how do we organize and mobilize quickly enough to do things like that? Because frankly, I'm at the point that I think people need to realize that we're in the matter of months within the year before this ship has sailed. They're trying to shut and really tear down the entire democratic structure in a very short amount of time. So it's really scary. I don't know the answer to it. I feel like this urgency that we need to be doing everything we can, pushing that red line to shut this down, but it also feels like we're stunned and don't know how to do it.
Something I've been playing with, I think COVID, like this country's always been pretty repressive, but COVID, I think, brought it up to a brand new level, because I was actually stunned by like people having like violent protests over wearing a mask and stuff like that. So we've moved in that direction, and the state has immense power. More and more, there's very little. Schumer keeps saying next time, or when he does this, or what do you say yesterday when Trump rejects a court ruling? It's like, well, he's done that many times already. And my point is, on the other hand, we always look for hope, right? And we're seeing pretty significant support for Mahmoud Khalil and others who have been just like literally kidnapped and abducted. And then what's really, I think, in some ways, maybe even inspiring, is what's going on with regard to Tesla and Musk. I'm assuming these are organic, they just spontaneous. I'm sure there are groups associated with it, but they came out of pretty quickly.
It feels that way. Yeah. And that, I think, I'm drawing frankly, a lot of hope from right now that, like, especially in the worlds we operate in, you think about social movements and organizing, and we forget how much potential there is of just the organic nature of when we all as a culture feel like we've just gone too far and crossed a threshold. And I see that in the Mahmoud Khalil, just snatched up off the street with the green card or nonviolent protest, pregnant wife. You can't get more obscene than that. But also with the Tesla vandalism and destruction, I do not think that this is at all connected to the Earth Liberation Front, like it might have been in the 90s or early 2000s or Earth First. This feels like people that are seeing the authoritarian slide that we're in right
Elon
now.
Musk.
They hate Elon Musk. But also speaks to, we've had so many debates about tactics in the environmental movement over the years. And at the end of the day, I think the general public doesn't care about property destruction. To me, this is a reminder of the tactics aren't what caused this repression. The efficacy of these movements caused the repression. And so that's why now you have Trump trying to talk about deporting Tesla vandals to other countries to lock up in supermax prisons and label as terrorists, right? Like, it has nothing to do with the vandalism. It's they're scared by that. And they're scared that this is a spontaneous, unruly movement that is going straight at corporate profits.
Yeah. Bobby, today, the attorney general kind of reiterated, we're coming after these people. We believe in law and order and all this shit. And again, I think that really ties in this because I've noticed like some of the more establishment things. I forget it was like Foreign Affairs or Wall Street Journal today, talking to an esteemed specialist who said, oh, yes, this is absolutely terrorism. There's that word again. So with Tesla, right? And so they're playing it into that again. But I think what's striking is that there is a significant level. Luigi Mangione, this guy became a funkier, all right?
And still,
so, yeah, there is like this under, somebody once told me it was James Baldwin. I've never confirmed it, but I always read it anyway. Something along the lines of beneath the pavement, that's where the truth lies. And that's, I think, what we're seeing, because we're not talking about this, but underneath, there's a lot of people who are really pissed off and tired of this. And it's just hard because the people who run the country won't get out of the way. And then you have, you know, the Democratic Party, which people like Slick Gavin Newsom are playing into these Republican ideas as well. So we're on our own, aren't we?
Yeah. I have the line I've heard more often than anything else in my career doing crisis journalism is no one is coming. I've heard it in war zones. I've heard it after natural disasters. I've heard it from protesters and lawyers. This idea that there's a moment where we realize, oh, someone's not going to swoop in and save us and fix us. And I think we're reaching that point as a country that we're realizing like, okay, the rest of the world is realizing like they have to organize or Ukraine without us. They have to deal with foreign aid without. I think people are starting to realize that we have to protect us. We have to take care of this. And there's an enormous amount of potential in that. Like, I don't know quite how to process it. Cause if you look at those moments in history, it's really hard to explain why things subtly shift into, I'll even go so far as to say like revolutionary potential of a historical moment. It's not clear. Like, I don't know, like what is the bridge too far? Is it one additional court ruling? Is it one more person snatched up off the street? Is it 1,000 more? But whatever it is, it's just this like bubbling up that I think we are seeing it right now. Shoot, even in Colorado, the Bernie and AOC rallies they're doing, you can say what you will about that of both of them, if they're going far enough or what they're doing. And, but 30,000 people.
So
I think people are hungry for it, hungry for an outlet to actually do something right now.
You know, I've seen a lot of people who describe themselves as very radical and extremist who are like making fun of or dismissing what's happening now with Sanders and AOC. But no, I agree. I think it's important. Not
and
that
those
they're,
people
like,
we
they're
can
not going to lead the revolution, but they're doing something. They're doing something, which obviously Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries and these people are. Let me ask you something. I don't know if you've ever really thought about this or talked about it, but I'm sure you've thought about it. But it's been your wheelhouse. And that's what RFK is doing right now, because in a lot of ways, he's more dangerous, I think, than anybody right now in that administration, because he's like getting people killed. And like how, because this does touch on things like the food supply and the environment. And I think you and I will criticize the food supply as well. We're not going to defend big ag and big pharma, but RFK, I think, is a different kind of cat. What are you seeing? Do you think there's a potential there for people to say, hey, we can't do this anymore. We've got to stand up to this guy.
Yeah, I think, I'm glad you bring that up, because I think RFK is, people are sleeping on it a little bit of how dangerous this man is. And even going so far as I'm seeing folks in some circles think that this is an opportunity, that you can cozy up to this dude, because he's really what people like RFK and this entire administration is doing, is they're taking the real frustrations and distrust that people have for things like big ag or the medical system or government, and then weaponizing it and manipulating it and turning it into something completely batshit crazy to push their agenda. And there's a few different ways of looking at it, but the way I see that is that the reason he's been able to be successful is there is that undercurrent of frustration and anxiety and demand for change. It's just that people are being like misdirected through all of his conspiracy theories and anti-vaxxer nonsense and everything else. And so I think we can't lose sight of that, that I think a lot of the folks that are falling for that rhetoric are getting there from a place of skepticism and criticism, and maybe that can be turned into a healthier dynamic. But I think we do need to remember that, dude, especially in the animal protection movement, I'm seeing some groups trying to like go after low hanging fruit wherever they can with RFK or with this administration. And that's just a recipe for suicide. There is no way that authoritarianism is going to be good for animals or the environment or our food supply. There's no possible outcome that this works out in our favor. So as tempting as it might be to jump on the conspiracy theory bandwagon and try to profit from it, it's not going to get us anywhere.
Yeah, I feel about conspiracies. One thing that struck me, it's not like I try not to be, and I told you, but for decades, people, and I'm a little older than you, and I'm sure you've been around people saying the same thing. Well, for decades, we've been talking about the news sucks. We didn't use the phrase fake news, but we talked about that. And we talked about elitism, and we talked about working class people and NAFTA and all these kinds of things, the food supply. And somehow the liberals just beat the shit out of us, and the right wing stole all these issues, and they don't believe in any of them. They're not like, we were on top of that stuff. And it's just really maddening. Right? That, you know.
Well, and especially look at the press.
Yeah.
Well, that's another example of what we were just talking about. There's legitimacy to these critiques. 100%. People are frustrated with the state of the news. It's the journalism today has not been delivering what we need for a healthy, critical society. But rather than looking at the structures that are in place and media ownership and corporate ownership and control of the news and how that limits journalists and how it's a push for profit rather than providing service and community, all of that critique has been lost in this like fake news simplification. Yeah. And I think it's another one of those examples, but that if we don't speak honestly and directly and make people uncomfortable sometimes with these conversations, the right's going to swoop in and simplify it and reduce it to something that they can weaponize for their benefit instead.
Yeah. This is some great talking to you all the time, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, but.
No, it's great, man.
Do you have a new book coming out?
I do. Yeah.
And this isn't in any way to dismiss what I think what you do is incredibly important. When you're dealing with the topics you do, it's always timely. That was like, everything you do is timely because fucking crisis doesn't go away. Right. It just keeps getting worse. It's from farm to Little Red Farms?
Little Red Barns.
Little Red Barns. From farm to fable.
Yeah,
I should have written it down. I relied on my memory.
No, it's okay. It's a surreal. I laughed when you brought it up. I got a book coming out. I've got a lot of feelings about this right now.
I know. Everything you do is timely. I didn't like, you have great timing, but unfortunately, like, the fucking thing never goes away.
It never goes away. And it's also, all of this is coalescing in a way that I worked on that book for many years.
Yeah.
And it started as an investigation of factory farms. But then as this conversation in a nutshell, it's connecting the dots to the larger tactics of political repression that have spread around the world and how also this issue is connected to the rise of fascism globally. So it's one of those things where it feels like, I would always tell my journalism students, sometimes the best time to be a journalist is also the worst time to be a journalist. And that's how it feels right now. Yeah, everything is very timely. This is straight out of the headlines, but it also, it feels a little surreal. It's like, I feel like I've been trying to make a warning that now is, I don't know what I'm trying to do right now. Yeah. It's not a time for warnings anymore. Now is a time of getting to the barricades and fighting back.
Yeah. So the books, your books are available everywhere. The next one isn't out yet, right? It's a few months away still.
Yeah. I'll make the shameless plug for pre-orders. It comes out at June 24th. The books will ship before that. But yeah, if people are interested in this, if anybody could help out with the pre-orders, it's a huge help because it helps establish this as something that people are talking about. But after it comes out, I'll be doing speaking events and touring a bit and hopefully talking to you guys again about it. So.
Absolutely. And maybe we'll cross paths. That would be great.
That'd be great.
Give us a few reasons not to panic. I'll put it on you because I got nothing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I appreciate that. Bob, thanks for looking out. Thanks for getting towards the head with the softball questions.
Hey, this is the kind of day where after you think of the world, you go out on your tribe, you just ride.
I think, but that is what I do. I mean, a lot of that. I'm struggling with it because it's both think we need to panic, but I think we need to acknowledge that the fear that we feel and the panic or anxiety is valid. But for folks that are listening to this, it really is that bad. This is not a Chicken Little. This is not a inflating or hyperbole. It is that bad. The stakes are that high right now. And I think we look at that, and if we honestly confront that reality, the other things that we're dealing with, I think, fall more into place, if that makes sense. I think there's something to be said for these moments in history where it feels like everything is coalescing and this like monstrosity that we don't know how to deal with. In those moments, some types of social change just become much more feasible because all of a sudden it like recalibrates us of what's at stake and what our other problems are that we're dealing with. And so that gives me a degree of hope. I guess I'm saying this out loud because I'm trying to do it personally too, of trying to remember like, all right, what I'm seeing is that bad. I have a reason to be concerned about my safety on things like book tour. But at the same time, it puts our blinders on of the work that needs to be done and the stuff that we also should not be focused on right now. And to me, that's things like infighting among social movements, trying to tear each other down, the like purity politics of thinking like our approach through whatever scholarship is more sound than this. And I think the time for that is done right now. This is a time where we realize who's on, frankly, who's more closely aligned with us and who the real opposition is. And I think if we keep that front and center, that's how we get through this. And realizing like who our people are and who the real opposition are, the people trying to destroy basic human rights, civil liberties and democracy itself.
I've been very critical of like Sanders and AOC, but I'm glad they're doing this. Somebody's got to do it. I wish, I'm not the biggest fan of a lot of the mainstream unions. They need to do this. Something else I've been doing media lately and teaching and everything. And one thing that I think is important is, and one thing I've stressed is that there's a long history of this in the United States. I mean, Trump, because a lot of liberals are now like discovering this because of Trump. This has been going on forever and it's bipartisan. And I think it's important for people to understand just like how ingrained. I keep using the H-Rap Brown's line. This is violence. This is America. It's cherry pie. I think people need to understand it. But at the same time, because I try not to get hysterical or anything, but I, like you, I, this is bad. And I like, there are some uber left people call themselves lefties. I don't know what they are. They're dismissing it. No, this is really bad. It really is. And
no, I say, as this has been my wheelhouse for my whole career. And I think I've been able to approach it with a level head throughout and tried to resist hyperbole or adjectives or like, I don't want to rile people. tribal, all that kind of thing. And I will say every drop of blood in my body is saying that this is as bad as it feels.
No, I agree. Right.
And the scholars of fascism are all saying that, scholars of human rights globally. And so I think it speaks to, and a journalism professor way back who would always say, when you don't know what to do, you have to do something. And that's just one of the truisms of this moment, that it feels like, oh my God, we don't know what we can possibly do against these threats, but we have to move. Like, we can't just be frozen in space. And so even if we take actions that aren't the best or the most strategic or the most effective, that's okay. I'm a really big proponent right now of just like, we have to get out there and be doing something, even if that's just as a kind of a coping mechanism to personally help you navigate these times, to be out there organizing a protest or a potluck or a community event or whatever it is you want to do. Just the action, I feel like something happens where we can kick ourselves into gear, and then other ideas come from that, other organizing. And so I feel it, man. I feel frozen a lot of these days too, especially doing the stuff we do, teaching, writing books, reading books. It just feels, what is the place for that in this world right now? But we just have to keep contributing wherever we can and keep moving.
Yeah. One thing I think it's important is, it's not, I used to say this all the time, less so now, it's not 1954 anymore, right? We don't have the same mechanisms like you would see at the beginning of the civil rights movement. It's just in the street, but we're not that far away either from it. And that's the part that's really terrifying. And the other part that I think is scary is, going up to 1954, you have a more or less of a progression, right? It wasn't like African-Americans were equal, then it was taken away and then they got it back. Now what we're doing is we're going back, fundamental things, whether it be civil rights or women's right to choose or whatever. And that's the part I think that people have to understand. That's scary, because when you start backsliding and taking away things that you had accepted, then you're in a different world. And that's the part I think we're really—
Well, and that's where, like, the new book, that this idea of the Little Red Barns, that's what that's referring to. We have to remember that fascists always mythologize the past. It's never about moving forward or expanding compassion, expanding rights. It's always going back to this mythical past and rewriting history. And this is what we're seeing, where they've had such effective attacks on education and the press, book bans, that there isn't a cultural understanding of how far we've come and how easy it is to go backwards at the same time. I will say, though, as a slightly positive spin or something to layer on top of that, like, when we talk about protest movements, it's easy to think of in the 60s of this heyday of activism, right? Or you think about resistance movements globally, and it's easy to build them up and think we don't have that right now, or it's not the same. And the movements are different right now, but what we do have is such a more robust understanding of how these mechanisms like repression work. Like, we've seen it develop over history and repeatedly in contemporary history. And I think we need to remember that. Like, we might feel weak right now, or we might not feel like we don't have millions out in the street, so we don't have X, Y, or Z that we need. But at the same time, I think there is a deep entrenched cultural understanding of what we're losing. And I think we have to gravitate to that and give an outlet for that right now.
Another part, and you're also like on a university, there was a time I don't think either of us are naive about university administrators. They're part of this kind of neoliberal state too, and they're not very good at it. I would say like universities are badly corporations, but I think, I don't know, I'm actually somewhat surprised by the total cave in. You don't expect much from a place like Columbia, but in Texas, where, you went to school there. I forget the name of it. I think it's SB 37. Essentially, the state's taking over university curriculums as well. So they would have, essentially, the Board of Regents would create a committee. They would look at your syllabus. They would come to class and evaluate you and talk to students and look at student reviews and all that kind of stuff. And they're also setting up a snitch hotline for students to complain. And that's the part that, you know, at least at some point in the past, universities would, I think more than lip service, they would actually take some of this stuff seriously. But now, you know, all it took was just a threat by Trump, who I actually think is in many ways a paper tiger. Like, he backs down a lot as soon as people stand up to him, but we're not seeing that. I mean, that part's really terrifying, right? These kind of bulwarks, right? Universities or unions or community groups or the Democratic Party, allegedly, right? They're failing us. So we really are kind of our own.
They are feeling, and I think the shared thread among that, it reminds me of kind of Schumer's capitulation as well, right? As this escalates, it's really tempting, especially from institutions like Columbia or the Democratic Party or corporations or whoever, rolling back DEI protections, to think that, well, we have to do whatever we can to keep this from getting worse, kind of thing. It's this mentality of this is the card, the hand we've been dealt. So we need to look out for whatever we can, do the best we can. And it's just such a weak, frankly, cowardly position of just accepting any scraps that fall off the table before they get swept away from us. And I think we should have learned by now that they're all going to get swept away. Like, we're not going to be able to catch those crumbs fast enough. And as soon as we do, there's going to be a next attack and a next. And so this is it's going to be a gut check, I think, for institutions and also for social movements of, do we actually understand that? And if we do understand it, what does the resistance to this look like right now? How hard do we fight back?
Hey, thanks. As always, the court case, I don't think it was shocking. I've talked to people in the last few months who said, I don't think anybody expected it to go out well because of what you're dealing with in North Dakota. Wasn't that? That's Kristi Noem's state, isn't it? Or she from South Dakota.
Yes. Oh, actually, I'm drawing a blank. I don't remember
at all, but they're not much different, right?
No, so, it's not a shock, but it's still shocking, right? And I think we need to take cases like this to realize the threat, but also the resilience of bouncing back from some of these blows, because I don't like to be doing interviews like this and have to remind people that there are more blows coming. Like, this is the strategy. This is a really big on social movements, and there are going to be others. And I think this is really a catalyzing moment that, unless we see these as what they are right now, they're going after core rights to protest and free speech. They're trying to shut all these movements down.
It's up to us. The courts aren't going to save us. Nope. The Democratic Party isn't going to save us.
It's up to popular movements. That's it.
It's always great talking to you. Well, definitely.
It's great talking
to you. And again, when the book is out, then we really appreciate it so much. This is Will Potter, really well-known journalist, author of Little Red Barns, forthcoming.
I got it.
Okay. And very well-known. Greenest that we read. Really appreciate it. This is Green and Red Podcast on Bob Azenko, and we'll have all the info in the show notes about how to follow us and on social media, listen to the podcast. We're on YouTube, social media platforms. And if you like it, donate a few bucks. We can always, we have a little bit over that. We can always use a few bucks. So we really appreciate it. And thank you so much, Will.
Thanks for talking to me, Bob. It was good talking to you today.